Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
I'm Tex Lerzel.
And we be drinking and we be swearing.
Fuck.
Okay.
Just figured it was time for a throwback.
Yeah, I love it. This is a show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Show enough.
Yes.
Okay, so today's the day that we're drinking wine coolers.
We are.
You never thought it would happen.
We both have sideways ponies.
Yes. I'm wearing Dayglow wrist warmers.
Yeah, I have approximately 17 scrunchies on.
Stacked. Multiple colors.
Yes.
So, yeah, today we are drinking some triple berry wine coolers, but these are not, we did not go to the store. We did not buy Bartles and James.
Or Seagram's.
Nope. Today we are drinking homemade wine coolers.
Artisanal.
Artisanal, yes. My story today is from the 80s, and what is more 80s than a wine cooler?
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing.
I'm actually scared. Like, nothing good comes out of the 80s except for us.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I was birthed in the 80s. So originally wine coolers, like when the idea of wine cooler first kind of came about, they were usually made at home. They were made using a light, dry white wine and usually paired with lemon lime soda. So basically it was like a tarted up spritzer, like a white wine spritzer, but with a little extra sugar and flavor in it. But then at the end of the 1970s, a couple of guys from California changed everything. By the early 1980s, wine coolers were being marketed as basically soda for adults.
Kind of accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. And it has alcohol in it, but it was like roughly the same amount of alcohol as a beer, like 4 to 6%. They came in individual sized, like 12-ounce bottles. So that made it really easy to have them at home. Whereas if you weren't going to make your own, you had to open a whole bottle of wine and, you know. And then they also had, which was a big deal in the early 80s, they had twist-off caps, which was very convenient.
Wow, the future.
Yeah. Basically, when they started making them in these individual bottles and selling them in four packs, the flavor had kind of evolved from like a tarted up white wine spritzer to including some fruit flavors as well. So it was more like kind of like a cross between a sangria and a white wine spritzer.
Okay, yes.
They usually contained real fruit, artificial fruit flavors, cheap wine, and some kind of fizzy soda or something. In 1985, the Chicago Tribune said that wine coolers accounted for close to 10% of all wine consumption in the United States. 10% in 1985. By 1987, at the wine cooler's peak, that number was up to 20%. Of all wine consumption in the U.S.
That's a lot of headaches.
Yes, I know. In the same year, 1987, sales topped $1 billion that year. So the original wine cooler was called California Cooler. That was the original brand, the first wine cooler ever. California Cooler was founded by a couple of Southern California 20-somethings. Michael Crete, the inventor of the wine cooler, said, "The gang would all get together on the beach in Santa Cruz, and I would mix together all these tropical flavors. Pineapple, grapefruit, lemon lime, white wine, and a little bit of club soda." So Crete got this idea because he was in wine and liquor sales.
Oh, okay.
So he's like, I can market this. People will buy this.
Yeah.
He paired up with a high school buddy of his who had a business degree. Mm-hmm. And they spent a year and a half perfecting some recipes and formulas and stuff before they went to market. And as soon as they hit the market, California Cooler took off like crazy. Gangbusters. They were everywhere. By 1984, they were selling 10 million cases a year. And then the big wine producers in California started to take notice and they wanted in. Gallo Wines, which is a big wine producer in California, was the company that invented Bartles and James, which was the biggest and most popular wine cooler ever. They had a lot of money for advertising, so they really flooded the market with these like primetime TV spots and kind of pushed California Cooler out of the way. And Seagram's hit the market as well with their own wine coolers. And California Cooler really started losing some serious market share because even though they were doing really well in the beginning, they just didn't have the money for advertising that Gallo did and Seagram's did.
Being the first is not a good place to be.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't last.
But either way, by 1987, wine coolers were everywhere. Everyone was drinking them. Unfortunately, 1988, the trend kind of started to die down. 1989, sales were kind of starting to plummet. But the real death knell for wine coolers came in 1991.
Smirnoff?
Congress passed a new tax law that more than quintupled the excise tax on wine from 17 cents a gallon in tax to $1.07 a gallon. Huge tax increase.
On which, beer too?
No, just on wine.
So this is like Bush doing this?
I'm not sure who in 91, yeah, it would have been Bush Senior, right?
No, I mean Bush like the...
Oh, Anheuser-Busch.
Anheuser-Busch, yes.
Bush with a C. Oh, it could have been lobbying. Yeah,
because like why wine and not that. Beer?
Yeah.
They're both the same.
A good question.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah. Mm. So.
This is my next scandal.
Right. Yeah. The wine cooler, like.
Coors Gate.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But so, yeah, they increased this tax on wine like through the roof, and it made wine blending really bad for business. So this is when sweet malt beverages entered the market, like Zima. Zima was like the first one, I think.
I remember people like kikiing about how bad Zima was, but yeah. It was a little before our time.
Yeah, yeah. It was super early 90s.
Yeah.
But it's basically like a lemony malt. So basically like a Smirnoff ice, but not quite as sophisticated as a Smirnoff ice.
That's sad.
Yeah. When this happened, when the excise tax went up and everybody started doing these malt beverages instead of wine beverages, Bartles and James and Seagram's both started putting out their own malt versions of wine coolers as well. Unfortunately, California Cooler did not survive. So that was the end of California Cooler.
R.I.P.
So that's the history of wine coolers. If you know anything about me and Stephanie, you'll know that A, we don't really like a cocktail that's too sweet. And B, I like to make a recipe. I need a recipe. I want to share it with y'all.
Yeah.
We need to put it on our Instagram. So going to the store and buying a 4-pack of Bartles and James doesn't cut the mustard.
Absolutely not. Wait, cut the mustard?
I don't think that's a phrase. I think I'm mixing two things together.
Yeah. I like it. I'm going to start saying it.
Yes. Cut that mustard. Cut the cheese. No. So... I found an article on The Kitchen that says that all you need to make your own wine coolers at home is to remember the ratio 4-4-2. You want to use 4 ounces of wine, 4 ounces of soda, and 2 ounces of liqueur or liquor. So you can make any flavor wine cooler you want as long as you use that ratio. You can use...
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, you can use a dry wine, you can use a red wine, you can use rosé, whatever, sweet... White Zinfandel, anything you want. You could use club soda. You could use squirt.
Ginger ale.
Grape soda, yeah. Orange soda, whatever you want, anything.
Orange.
And then you could use like elderflower liqueur.
Campari.
Anything. Yeah, obviously. Campari. Oh, yeah, Campari would be great.
Right.
But because we wanted to go super 80s today, I decided to keep it with that sort of like early classic recipe with the dry light white wine and lemon lime soda. But then because we wanted to give it that real 80s twist, I soaked some frozen mixed berries in triple sec to make myself a triple berry triple sec. So we're having triple berry wine coolers. So that means it's time to taste finally. They look really pretty.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Ooh.
That's delicious.
That's so good.
It's a little sweet for me.
It tastes like juice.
So 80s. Damn, that's dangerous. I could drink so many of these.
It's very, very drinkable.
Damn it.
But it's a lower alcohol.
Yeah, certainly less alcohol in it than like vodka or something. So it's got added liquor to it, but not like, it's a liqueur.
It's no monkey gland.
True story. On that note, let me talk about something a little heavier today. Let me take another sip of this. Delicious.
Tux tried to warn me and I don't know what it's going to be about, you guys, but I'm scared. The 80s was a bad time.
Sure was, yeah. We were doing some terrible stuff. So today, I'm going to be talking about a really awful chapter in our nation's book on police terrorism and violence against Black communities and Black citizens. So in West Philadelphia, on May 13th, 1985, city police dropped a bomb from a police helicopter onto a row house owned by a black liberation group called MOVE. I'm sure you've heard of this, at least.
Yes, I know about how they just blew up that building to get one person.
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than I thought it was. When I first saw this story somewhere, I was like, oh, okay, like that's fucked up, but I think I know what this is, and I kind of saved it away for later. But once I started researching, there's a lot more to it than
I think that's every scandal.
Every scandal.
You think you know what it is, but you have no idea.
No clue.
Isn't that some tagline from, like...
It should be.
Okay.
It's the tagline from Beyond Reproach, I think. Yeah, so despite the fact that the fire department was on the scene at the time that this bomb was dropped, official orders from the police commissioner were to let the fire burn. And that decision destroyed an entire predominantly black middle-class neighborhood in West Philadelphia. And Philadelphia residents watched in stunned disbelief as 61 homes went up in flames and 11 people were killed. The city of Philadelphia bombed their own people.
Yeah.
And people don't even know that this happened. I mean, you knew.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't realize that this ever happened.
I think all black people, not all.
Yeah.
Not all black people. Hashtag. But it is something that I learned about. Tangential to the civil rights movement.
Okay, yeah.
Even though it wasn't that era, like, it was something that, like, I overheard in those discussions.
Yeah.
And I was, I couldn't believe it, but also I could believe it. Because Tulsa, like, this is just the history of this country.
Yeah.
Like, Tulsa happened.
Yeah, exactly.
This is, like, a continuation of that pattern of terrorism.
Totally. It is a different sort of situation from Tulsa, because Tulsa was more, I mean, the police didn't help the situation, but it was more private citizens.
Yeah.
That destroyed Tulsa's district, but... So today, I would like to propose a toast. Raise your glass.
Yes.
To black lives and black communities.
Hell yes.
I shouldn't have to say this, but black lives should not only matter to people in this country when they've been murdered. I feel like people only really pay attention or care when somebody has been killed, and that's fucked up. Police commit acts of violence and terrorism against black Americans every day without killing them.
Yeah.
And that is still not okay.
Yeah, the whole system is violence.
Yes. Not murdering someone throughout the course of your day at work should not be the hallmark of a job well done.
Yeah, but it kind of is.
I mean, yeah. Good for you.
Yeah.
You didn't murder anyone today. Gold star.
What restraint.
All right, so let's talk about MOVE a little bit. MOVE... By the way, MOVE is not an acronym. That's just the name of the organization. It doesn't stand for anything.
Oh, okay.
They were just called MOVE. MOVE was a political and religious organization founded in 1972 by a Korean War vet and West Philly native named John Africa. He had been born Vincent Lephart, but he changed his name to Africa to honor the country that he believed human life had begun.
Okay.
MOVE's ideology combined black revolutionary ideas with radical environmentalism and animal rights. They believed in composting, homeschooling, and vegan raw food diets, and they opposed medicine, science, technology, and government. They were not exclusively a black organization. Most of their members were black, but they had at least, from the footage that I've seen, they had at least one or two white members.
Okay.
But most of their members were black. They lived communally, and they described themselves as a family, and they also, everyone in the organization, changed their names to Africa, their last names.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. They also wore their hair in dreadlocks, the black members, mm-hmm. which in the early 1970s was considered extremely radical. Very few people were doing this, especially very few American mm-hmm. people were wearing their hair in dreadlocks at this time. A few key important figures started to, and which increased visibility for dreadlocks, you know, in the 70s.
Yeah, like George Clinton.
Yeah. But in the early 1970s, when they started doing this, it was like, people were like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
Most people today would look back at this organization and probably think they were kind of a cult, mm-hmm. especially considering they all changed their name to Africa.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, in the early years of their group, they were more like a cross between a hippie commune and a black liberation group like the Black Panthers. They, one article that I read said that they combined black power with flower power.
Oh, cool.
They were a very peaceful organization in the beginning, in the early 70s. In the early 70s, they organized several nonviolent demonstrations to protest animal cruelty at zoos and puppy mills and pet stores. They also protested against war, police brutality, and the American education system. And of course, the Philadelphia Police Department was having none of it.
Yeah.
They were like, excuse me, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Almost immediately, MOVE was under extremely heavy surveillance. And between 1972 and 1978, there were 193 arrests of MOVE members and 93 trials in a six-year period. But we're talking about a group that was only in Philly, and they all lived together in one house. This was not a big group of people to have 193 arrests.
Yeah, they were being surveilled.
Yeah. I'm guessing, I don't have like official numbers on membership. I'm guessing from what I've seen and what I've read, maybe 30 adults in this group.
Wow.
Maybe. Probably less. I could be wrong. Maybe there were more in the beginning, but I'm guessing there's probably less than 30 people. 193 arrests in 6 years.
How powerful were these 30 people that they needed to drop a bomb on them?
Seriously.
And just how small is the Philly government that they felt so threatened by 30 people?
Yeah. It, actually, by the time the bomb was dropped, there were even less people than that.
Yeah.
The more MOVE was targeted by the police, the more sort of erratic and militant their behavior became. Obviously, they're trying to defend themselves against...
The police have it out for you.
Yeah, exactly. And in the beginning, they weren't doing anything wrong.
They had the wrong look, and they were talking.
Yeah, exactly. So they started squatting in this house in a neighborhood in West Philadelphia near the University of Pennsylvania. This was a pretty diverse and open-minded, kind of progressive neighborhood. And at first, their neighbors were very sympathetic and kind of agreed with their mission and what they were saying. But as the group became more and more militant, the neighbors started to kind of start complaining to the city about them because they felt threatened by this group. They would go up to the roof of this building dressed in army fatigues and carry rifles and like march around the roof and kind of like brandish them at people that were walking by, just like random people are walking by. Mm. And then they got some megaphones and they started... I mean, they were calling for the release of members of the group that were in jail because of these protests, which they should not have been in jail in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's understandable the reason they were doing what they were doing, but it was a very diverse neighborhood, and these people tried to sort of welcome them, and all of a sudden they were like, now you're a threat, and you're scaring my kids.
Yeah. Well, the people don't know that they're being harassed.
Totally. Yeah.
Like night and day by the cops.
Yeah. Exactly. So the neighbors started pressuring the city to do something about it, get them out of this house that they're squatting in illegally. Mm-hmm. And in 1978, in the summer, the city decided to make a deal with MOVE. The deal was that in exchange for the city releasing several members of the organization...
What were they holding them on?
I don't know.
They didn't do anything.
Yeah.
But I mean, again, what a stupid question.
Yeah, I mean, they were getting sort of increasingly more militant, so they had... They did have weapons and things that they might not have had licenses for. Yeah. Who knows what it was.
But the making people
terrorist
that they,
threats was
that
one
they
of the,
took, it seemed like that was like early on, like at a protest or something.
It just kept escalating. Oh, okay. It started in 1972. By this point, it's 1978.
Oh, wow.
And things had moved quickly by this point. So the city was like, okay, we'll release some of your members from jail or several members from jail if you turn over all the weapons that you have in the house and you leave this house that you're squatting in illegally. And basically just like go away. MOVE agreed to these terms. The city released the prisoners, and then MOVE didn't do anything. They did not leave the house. They never turned over any weapons. Hmm. And the city was like, okay, fuck you.
Yeah.
So the police decided no more Mr. Nice Racist.
No.
They decided it was time to force them out of this house, whether they liked it or not. And they showed up with water cannons, which were like... Basically, like fire hoses from a fire truck.
Fire hoses? Really? We're bringing that back?
Well, to like point at the house to try and like break the windows or something. I'm not sure what the point was. Okay. So they show up with these water cannons and battering rams to try and get them out of the house, break in the house and force them out. There was a standoff because they had weapons in the house. And at some point during the day, a shot was heard coming from the basement, which led to a police shootout between the members of the household and the police.
Okay.
In the course of the shootout, one officer was shot and killed. And 16 other officers and firefighters were injured. Eventually, MOVE did surrender. They came out of the house unarmed with their hands up. Mm-hmm. Of course, they were, you know, had the shit beat out of them as they were exiting the house.
Yeah, I mean, they're exiting the house in front of the police.
Yeah. Multiple eyewitness accounts say that the shots may have actually come from the opposite direction of the basement, and that there's a possibility that the officer who was killed was actually killed by another officer who was shooting at the house. Of course, there's no proof of this, and MOVE agrees with it. Everyone else disagrees.
Yeah.
But either way, 2 years later, 9 members of MOVE were tried. They were called the MOVE 9, convicted of third-degree murder in the officer's death, and sentenced to life in prison. 9 people. Everyone else in the group was evicted from the house, and the house was demolished, basically to keep them from going back. Like, you can't live here, so we're just going to tear your house down. So at this point, they moved further west into West Philadelphia, into a row home owned by a member's sister at 6221 Osage Avenue. This was a quiet, tidy, old, tree-lined neighborhood in a middle-class, predominantly black neighborhood. Just like the last neighborhood, they basically immediately set about pissing off all the neighbors.
Yeah.
They started piling up a bunch of trash and wood and stuff outside the house. I don't know exactly what the point of it was, but they...
Maybe they were composting.
Yeah. So this all, you know, all this trash and wood and crap piled up outside the house started attracting rodents.
Of course.
Roaches, yeah. Rats. And everyone else in the neighborhood is like, this is a quiet, residential, cute little tree-lined neighborhood. Y'all need to get a grip. Like, get out of here. What are you doing? We're just trying to have nice things.
Yeah.
They also started boarding up all the windows and the doors with, like, big pieces of wood, slats of wood and stuff. Basically, they're, like, building a fortified bunker.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm talking, like, row houses. All the homes are right next to each other. It's an old neighborhood, so they're, like, these cute little neighborhood, like, cute little houses with porches.
I love Philly. Philly is so adorable. The row houses are basically free.
Yeah.
But they're right next to each other.
Yeah.
They have tiny little, like, I don't even know if you can call them front yards.
They even built a steel-lined guard tower on the roof with, like, little slats where they could, like, put a gun out, like a...
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. That's an aggressive look.
Yes. And they mounted loudspeakers on the side of the building. Basically, because they, you know, in the last house, they were doing these, like, political messages where they were calling for the release of jailed members and threatening members of the city government. But this time, it got increasingly violent and aggressive and loud. They even started calling out the neighbors in the neighborhood. If anyone complained to them about the mess or the noise, they would just start screaming about the people in the neighborhood being an asshole and blah, blah, blah.
Stephanie Domingo, she's a bitch.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate her.
And it really didn't matter to them what time of day it was, what time of night it was. It could be 2 or 3 in the morning, and these loudspeakers would be going at top volume. There could be kids playing in the street, and they would be cursing and screaming and ranting. I have a few different clips.
This is a blue-collar neighborhood. Any given summer day, you have the children playing in the streets. You have mother maybe sitting on the steps, neighbors talking to each other. And all of a sudden, on the loudspeaker, you'd hear a voice would come out and say, "You motherfuckers, what the fuck are you doing out here now? Do you know what's going on here? You son of a bitches, you're around here fucking everybody up. What the fuck is going on?" Anything that was vile, they would go into it.
Motherfucker. filth. It was unbelievable.
And this,
that
went on
this
for...
could be in something like this could be in someone's mind.
It's one thing to be two blocks away and hear it, but to live right next door, full blast in our bedroom. I watched my wife many nights later in that bed and cry with nothing else she could do. I think the, what we really hoped for was that some kind of way the city would find a way to deal with this situation.
So by this point, this would be like the early 80s, probably like 82, 83.
So this has almost been a year?
They lived on Osage Avenue for about 3 years before the city finally did something about it. By this point, there was a new mayor in Philadelphia. Philly had elected Wilson Good, who was the first black mayor in Philadelphia's history.
Okay.
At first, he said that he wanted to avoid confrontation with the group. He said it was better, quote, to have dirt and some smell than to have blood.
Yeah.
But eventually, you know, like I said, they were on Osage Avenue for 3 years, and the neighbors got to a point where they just could not take it anymore.
Yeah.
And they were complaining to the city constantly and calling the police constantly. So finally, Mayor Good decided it was time to give the order to evict move from this house on Osage Avenue.
I don't know why it took that long, but...
It's a black neighborhood, so they don't care.
There we go.
Yeah. They don't care.
Okay. What a stupid question.
When the mayor issued the order to evict them... The police also issued arrest warrants for four of the members in the house. They were alleging parole violations, illegal possession of firearms, and making terrorist threats. So, obviously, because of what had happened in the last time, in the last house they were in, the police knew that there was going to be a standoff and that they weren't going to leave the house quietly or easily. So they decided this time around they were going to evacuate the neighborhood in advance of trying to get them out of the home, just to make sure there were no... unintentional injuries of neighbors or whatever, and the neighbors wouldn't be there to see what was going on. So on May 12th, 1985, which was actually Mother's Day, they evacuated the entire neighborhood. And they told the residents of the neighborhood...
I don't like that. That's not a good sign.
Yeah.
It's like, no witnesses. Uh-huh. But the first black anything, the first woman, like, they have to be... over and beyond aggressive.
Yeah.
Or they're seen as weak.
Yeah.
You know?
So they basically told all the residents in the neighborhood, go ahead and grab like some clothes, a change of clothes, grab your toothbrushes or whatever. You're going to be home in 24 hours. But so you don't need a lot of stuff. Just grab what you'll need for the next 24 hours.
Of course, on Mother's Day, the evacuation has been slow. People had plans for today. A few had decided that they'd stay and not evacuate, but police have now apparently advised those people that they think it's best that they leave.
I hope that it's resolved quickly and have all confidence that the mayor is going to be doing the right thing.
I wouldn't mind staying myself, you see, but I was told to leave because you don't know what the extent of this is going to be, you know?
What do you think?
I think, believe it or not, I think you'll have to kill all of you.
And neighbors have been told by police not to return to their homes for 24 hours. That's 10 o'clock tomorrow night. Now, what will happen between now and then remains to be seen, Charles.
And Casey, some of the neighbors, as they were leaving, said to me that as they were going, leaving the neighborhood, the move people were sitting out in front of the move house, the children in hand. Perhaps that was a subtle or not so subtle indication of what's happening here.
They didn't have to do this on Mother's Day.
Seriously, like, why is it on Mother's Day?
That's gross.
It doesn't make any sense. Black
people don't care about their mothers, don't you know?
You're just hearing the footage, but like watching it. I wish I could have the thing turned around so you could see the people. It's like little old ladies with walkers trying to get out of their homes. Nobody really knew exactly how many people were in the house at this point. Several members were in jail. Those nine other members were in prison for the murder of the police officer.
So like eight people?
They were guessing six adults.
Okay.
Six adults and as many as 12 children. But they weren't exactly sure. Either way, the police promised the mayor that there would not be any gunfire this time. That there wouldn't be a shootout because, you know, there's kids and there's not that many people there. So guess how many police officers showed up the next morning to evict them?
Every single one.
Over 500.
That sounds about right.
Yes, for six adults.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Early morning, May 13th, 1985, the day after Mother's Day, more than 500 police officers surrounded the move house.
You don't want anyone to see that.
Seriously,
you know?
Yeah. They were equipped with flak jackets, tear gas, smoke grenades, SWAT gear, 50 and 60 caliber machine guns, an anti-tank machine gun, and several water cannons on fire trucks. There's not going to be a shootout, though. They promised the mayor. That's why they brought all those machine guns.
Yeah, and all those people. It's just going to be real, real peaceful. Like,
so at 5:35,
we just don't want the neighbors to see all this peace. Yeah, that's about
exactly.
To be up in,
yes,
up in here.
So at 5:35 a.m., the police announced over a megaphone that they had arrest warrants and that everyone from Move had 15 minutes to surrender and exit the house. At 5:30 a.m., they're like, "You got to get out of here in 15 minutes, or that's it." The police commissioner read a speech, a long speech over the loudspeaker.
Do we have the speech?
I have the beginning of it. I don't have the whole speech.
I'm excited.
The speech started with, "Attention, Move. This is America. You have to abide by the laws of the United States."
Oh, that's so good.
Like, what?
Oh, man. I love it.
Girl.
Go on.
Yeah. So no one came out of the house. The 15 minutes came and went. Nobody
what?
Came out. Surprise, surprise. And when no one came out, the police immediately started their attack with tear gas, smoke grenades, and water cannons at this little tiny house. At some point that day, gunfire broke out. Surprise. No one is exactly clear who fired the first shot. The police say that it was the Move house. The Move people say that it was the police. But either way, the shootout lasted for 90 minutes. And in the course of 90 minutes, 500 plus police officers fired 10,000 rounds of ammunition.
Oh my God.
10,000 rounds at this tiny little row house with six adults in it and as many as 12 children to their knowledge. In fact, the only reason they stopped firing at the house is they ran out of bullets and had to call the police academy to send more.
Wow.
Meanwhile, SWAT teams had gone into the neighboring row houses and they were trying to blast holes through the walls of the houses so that they could get into the Move house. You know, like if they came into my house and were trying to get into the house next door, basically, okay. Through the wall.
Yeah, through the wall.
The neighbors didn't know any of this was happening. This was not what they were told.
Of course.
They were told.
But that's why they were moved.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Because if they told them, like, "Hey, we're going to blast holes in your walls to get them," they'd be like, "Fuck out of
here. Absolutely
not. I'm not going anywhere."
Yeah.
Also, it's Mother's Day, so fuck you.
Yeah, yeah. That plan didn't work. They didn't get through. This just kept going on all day. Gunshots and smoke grenades and tear gas filled the streets. People were everywhere. Like, at the edges of the block, they had police lines.
Of course.
There were news cameras and just bystanders everywhere, but they had to keep moving people back because the tear gas kept getting thicker and thicker throughout the day, and then there was gunfire, so they just kept pushing the barriers back.
Like, how are people supposed to come out when there's all this...
Exactly.
All
seriously.
These bullets flying.
Yeah. So you're just going
to
step out.
Us to come out to our death?
Like, exactly.
Be riddled with bullets? Like,
and then you're
and
surprised
children?
That they don't?
Yeah.
The house is being blasted with gunfire, but obviously the houses on either side are also completely being shot up and down.
Wow.
And, you know, this is going on all day. The cops can't get inside. The Move people are obviously not coming out at this point. So finally, Mayor Good gives a press conference and he says he tells reporters he wanted to, quote, "seize control of the house by any means possible." And this is when, in the afternoon, he gave the police the go-ahead to drop a bomb onto the top of the house.
I mean, they knew that they were going to drop this bomb.
Yeah, they basically, the point was they wanted to destroy the bunker that was on the roof, the, like, guard tower that I talked about. Mm-hmm. They thought that just as a tactical goal that if they could destroy that guard tower that they could get closer to the house and get the door open or
so
something.
So have the Move people, like, have they killed anyone? Like, have they, like, from this guard tower? Oh, okay.
No,
okay.
No.
It is an aggressive look.
Yeah.
But, like, to drop a bomb on someone who didn't do anything,
yeah,
is insane.
I mean, they're firing back from the guard tower at this point, but they're not,
yeah,
they haven't actually killed anyone.
I mean, we've, yeah, had mass shooters who are able to just get into cop cars afterwards.
Oh, 100%. We take them to fucking McDonald's and buy them a hamburger. So the police load a police helicopter with a bag of C4 plastic explosives.
Oh, God.
The same kind the United States military used in Vietnam.
Wow.
To drop onto a residential row house in Philadelphia. They drop this bomb. Everyone nearby hears it. Everyone feels the of force course. Of it. Basically, everyone in Philadelphia watched this happen on the news. They saw the moment of impact on the TV. And they also saw that this rooftop bunker that was the target of the police bomb was still standing. The bomb had not done shit. What it had done, though, was start a fire on the roof. Yes.
Oh, no.
Within moments, smoke started billowing over the tops of all these row houses in this neighborhood. The smoke just kept getting thicker and thicker, moving further and further across the city. You could see the smoke literally across the city.
Wow.
And the fire seemed to be spreading, and the police commissioner told firefighters not to put it out. Later, he was interviewed, and he said, "I communicated that I would like to let the fire burn." It was later claimed that he feared that if the firefighters got too close, that they could become targets of gunfire.
I mean, that's a good, like, reverse logic.
Yeah, exactly.
Why
would they be shooting at the firefighters that are trying to put their house out?
Yeah, because we don't need our homes.
Yeah.
Let the fire have it.
So within 45 minutes, they let this fire burn.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Within 45 minutes, three more homes were on fire.
Of course.
Then, finally, the roof collapsed. The roof sort of buckled under the flames and fell into the house. But by this point, it was too late. The firefighters were finally given the go-ahead to try to put the fire out. But, three other homes were already on fire by this point. Mm-hmm. And this is a tiny, narrow little street.
Yeah.
The fire department is trying to get through, still worried about the possibility that there's people inside with guns. And so within 90 minutes after they finally started, the entire north side of Osage Avenue was on fire. The entire row of homes.
Yeah.
Becoming a very emotional scene. With me is Janice Walker. She lives at 6217 Osage, just two doors from the move house.
Yes.
And you're afraid that your house may be on fire.
I'm sure. It's just destroyed, and it's just not fair. We've been there over 20 years, and we didn't have to go through this.
We only left with a few odds and ends, for the night. We had no idea it was going to be this devastating.
You got innocent people that live around there on Osage Avenue, and they just, their properties is just gone up in smoke.
Wow.
As I said before, Philadelphia streets are famously really narrow, especially in the older neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So the trees that were both behind the row of homes and the trees out on the street in front were starting to catch on fire as well, which just helped spread the fire in all directions.
Yeah.
Before long, the homes across the street on Osage on the other side of the street were also on fire.
Wow.
And not long after that, homes behind the row on Pine Street were also burning. By that evening, three entire rows of homes were completely, completely on fire. Not just like one home in the middle of the row, the entire row. Flames could be seen from planes landing at the airport more than 6 miles away. And the firefighters were not able to get the blaze under control until just before midnight. But by that point, it was too late. 61 homes were completely destroyed, like burned to the ground.
Of course, yeah. If only there were like 500 firefighters.
Seriously. So this left more than 250 people homeless overnight. This was the worst residential fire in Philadelphia's history, and the city had started it and let it burn on purpose.
Yep. Yeah. They would never do this. Obviously, they'd never do this to a white neighborhood. Duh. But wow.
I have a picture of what this looked like the next day for you. This will go on our Instagram, but...
Oh, my God.
Like, burned out shells of homes.
Wow.
Nothing left.
And people, like white people, are mad about a CVS, like window being broken.
Yeah, seriously.
Like, think of the property damage.
The day that this happened, there were 13 people in the move house. It was later discovered.
Okay.
Of the 13 people, only two made it out alive. 29-year-old Ramona Africa and 13-year-old Birdie Africa. They were both badly burned trying to escape the fire, but 11 other people, including five children, burned to death in the basement of the home. Officer James Berghire later said, "Out of the smoke, the first person I saw was Ramona. Then I see who was later identified as Birdie come out of the house. I ran out and scooped him underneath his left arm." So Berghire single-handedly saved Birdie's life, this 13-year-old boy that was coming out. At the time, his fellow officers
got really mad at him.
They were telling him not to.
Obviously.
They told him that it was a trap and that he would be shot at.
Yeah.
This whole home, like not like there's a fire.
Look at you thinking a child is a child.
Yeah.
Worth saving. He was probably fired.
He wasn't fired, but he did
face some disciplinary action.
So he did it anyways. He went and saved Birdie. He later told the Guardian that he's still to this day haunted by the image of Birdie walking through this like wall of fire to come out.
Yeah.
He said, "Five kids died and the neighbors lost everything. We failed and it bothers me. Nobody ever seemed to care. Even to this day."
He's in the wrong profession.
I know. "Even to this day, I carry a lot of guilt because of those five kids. I was only a wall away from them. People say to me, 'But you didn't know.' But you can't help thinking about it. They died a horrible death."
Yeah, being burned alive is the worst death ever.
Yeah.
It's amazing that he feels bad. Like, that gives me hope.
So months after the fire, there was a commission. The city held commission hearings. I don't know if the point was to try and assign some kind of blame or decide who was at fault, or if they were just trying to figure out, like,
why. They have to investigate.
Yeah. But so they held these commission hearings, and Berghire testified.
"Is it like being in a war?
It's just too many things that go on to sit here and just say how you felt. I thought about the kids in the house. I thought about my kids. I thought about a lot of things. But to sit here and I couldn't answer that."
Mm-hmm. I've been sitting here listening for many days, and I've read scores of pages of reports and testimony. And it has all been, all of it, very depressing and very discouraging. Except what I've read about Officer Berghire and what I've heard from Officer Berghire. And if there's any hope in this whole sorry situation, it's because of that officer, and I want to thank him."
Yeah, seriously.
Thank you, sir.
There is one police officer with empathy.
Over 500.
But that's like... To me, that's good. Well, I would think there would be none.
Well, so after his testimony that he gave during this commission hearing, he went back to work and found the words
"rat,"
"N-word lover" written in his locker.
Yeah.
And in 1987, he was diagnosed with PTSD and left the police force. Oh. And now
the
good
ones always leave. Yeah. The ones that remain are the worst humans on the planet.
It's so fucked up.
But there was one, and he suffered greatly for it. Mm-hmm. But I hope he found a better career, because he doesn't belong with them.
Yeah, he struggled a lot. I read a lot about what happened to him. I kind of took it out of my outline, but he like couldn't find a job. He ended up working at a bar. He worked it as a janitor. His wife left him.
Wow.
Eventually,
ruined.
Yeah, he did kind of pull it. He now works for a nonprofit and he's remarried, so things are better now. But he gave this interview. I can't remember the full quote, but during the interview, he started crying and he said, basically, like, "I'll find peace when I'm dead."
Yeah.
So after the fire, Birdie Africa was sent to live with his father. His name was changed to Michael Moses Ward, and he was instrumental in telling the city government and the police and everyone who was in the home, how many people were in the home, what was going on when all this was happening. They were basically all holed up in the basement, trying to escape the gunshots and everything.
Of course.
But the basement was filling with all this water because of the water cannons. So then when the fire started, they thought they would be kind of safe down in the basement because of all the water, but they still, obviously they were not.
Wow.
But so his name was changed to Michael Moses Ward, and he never saw anyone for MOVE ever again.
Okay.
Lived with his father. He ended up kind of living a relatively normal life, but he died really young. Hmm. I think in his like 40s or something.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Ramona Africa was arrested, charged with riot and conspiracy, and spent the next 7 years in prison. Mayor Good repeatedly took responsibility. He said, "As mayor of the city, I accept full and total responsibility." But he went on to say, "There was no way to avoid it. no way to extract ourselves from that situation except by armed confrontation. The police commissioner who was involved resigned a few months later, but sort of blamed the mayor and kind of made it sound like he was forced out. There were two grand jury investigations, a civil suit, and this commission report that cited the bombing as reckless, ill-conceived, and hastily approved. But with all of that, no one was ever criminally charged for what happened that day.
Of course not.
And there's
this
never
is America.
Even, yeah,
you can shoot people in their sleep.
Yeah, there's never even been a formal apology from the city.
Okay, you can shoot black people in their sleep.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. So obviously, it's tragic that this happened and that there were children and that people died in this horrific way.
Yeah, this community was destroyed.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. I think that really what the most fucked up part of the story is what happened to these poor neighbors in this neighborhood, that they went to the city asking for help.
Yeah.
And the next thing they knew, they had lost everything overnight.
Yeah. They didn't say like, hey, can you drop a bomb on our neighbors?
And burn down our whole neighborhood, please.
Burn down six blocks. Could you do that for us?
A neighbor who, he didn't live on Osage, but he lived really close nearby, later said, people don't know what they did to these houses. These people were out here crying. They lost their great-grandparents' pictures.
Yeah.
And stuff they couldn't replace.
Yeah.
One lady that lived over there, she lost her mind. She lost her mind.
Of course.
They put her in a home.
Yeah.
So after the fire, the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority took the properties, the burned out properties, by eminent domain. They hired a developer to rebuild them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this is sort of an honorable thought. They had this idea to kind of help make things right. They hired a black construction company, black owned construction company, and contractor to rebuild. But they couldn't find one, a black-owned construction company that had any experience of a project of this scale.
Okay.
But they did, they hired him anyways.
Okay.
A year later.
I mean, Philly is all about just like black and face only kind of thing.
Yeah.
So this does not surprise me.
Yeah, they wanted to, but like black people don't get construction jobs of this size. It's just not done, especially in the 80s.
Yeah, they don't get them now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. So a year later, the homes had been replaced and rebuilt with these contemporary 80s-style row houses with open floor plans and big windows and high ceilings. And the neighbors
were... Was there, like, insurance money? Like, the people
I don't know what people got. I did find out that in 2000...
When the city burns down your house, you don't get anything?
I couldn't find anything. I looked and looked and looked.
Stop it.
In 2005, 20 years later, there was a settlement. They got, like, $12.8 million from the city. But not until 2005. And I don't know if there was something else, but I really...
No!
I wanted to find this, and I looked and looked and looked and couldn't find
so
what they received.
Okay, so they destroyed the lives of a community. Wow.
I could be wrong. There might have been something, but I read countless articles looking for this and couldn't find it.
Wow.
I knew you were going to ask that.
Obviously, because I just assumed.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyways.
The homes were replaced. The neighbors are thrilled to finally get their lives back and move back into these homes. You know, they're like, we can have our life back on our nice, quiet, you know, family-oriented little neighborhood by the park. But before long, it became clear that the construction was cheap, shoddy, and rushed.
Because these buildings are historic.
Yeah.
Like, they're so solid. There's a reason why they couldn't break through the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it was strong.
Yeah.
It was built to last
mm-hmm.
until you drop a bomb on it and let the fire burn.
One resident said... The first winter, we had maybe 20-some-odd roof leaks.
Oh, no.
Then it went downhill from there.
Oh, no.
The electrical wiring was faulty. The plumbing was bad. The ceilings drooped. The city was paying for repairs, but before long, it became clear that the houses needed more work than they were even worth. So by the early 2000s, the city decided they were going to offer a buyout instead of continuing to pay for repairs on these homes.
That's one way to get them out of the community.
Yeah. They offered everyone in the neighborhood that was still there $150,000 for each home.
That's nothing. That's $0.
I think that was actually high for that neighborhood at the time.
But trauma of
losing I know, obviously.
Everything.
Yeah.
And then living in some shitty house. They paid a black contractor, I'm sure, because it's like, you know, it's a figurehead sort of thing.
Yes.
But also because it's cheaper.
Yeah. About 2/3 of the people in the neighborhood took the deal and left. Their homes were boarded up and condemned. But that left the remaining neighbors who are still there with these shitty, crumbling homes, which were now sandwiched between vacant, condemned, boarded-up homes. This was once a vibrant community.
Yeah.
kids playing in the street, neighbors barbecuing together, and and it was it's a ghost town version of what it was. These homes sat vacant and boarded up for over a decade.
Wow.
The city just couldn't decide what they were going to do with them. Finally, they decided that just a couple of years ago, they decided that it was going to be cheaper and easier if they just sold the homes to a developer and let the developer deal with it than for the city to sort of oversee the project and make sure it's done in a way that they wanted it. So there were 36 homes that had been condemned. The city sold all 36 of them to a developer for $1. And they're currently being completely gutted and stripped out and replaced with luxury condos with quartz countertops and central air. And a few of them have actually already been completed and are on the market right now, starting at $260,000, which is extremely high for that part of Philadelphia.
That's a lot for Philly, period.
Period.
Yeah.
But yeah, that far, it's like so far into West Philly that it's like you're like two blocks from the edge of Philadelphia getting, some neighbors have actually asked about, now that the homes are being rebuilt, the neighbors that took the buyout have been asking about trying to go back and live in these new homes. Mm-hmm. But since they took the buyout, the city's no longer a part of the equation and it's too late. They would have to buy the homes from the developer at market cost. The neighbors who stayed are cautiously optimistic about what's going to happen to their neighborhood next. They're very worried about gentrification, obviously.
Yeah.
There were some stipulations when the city worked out this deal with the developer. There's stipulations that the homes have to be owned by the people living in them. Like they can't be rented out and they can't be
subletted. Airbnb'd. Yeah.
So that's good, I guess, at least.
Yeah.
And it does look like it's mostly sort of young Black professionals that are moving back into the neighborhood now. So the neighborhood, like I said, these people are kind of cautiously optimistic, but they also made sure that the city agreed not to put up any kind of historical markers saying what happened there, saying anything about MOVE or the bombing or the fire. They just don't want to be reminded of what happened to them.
See, I don't think that's great. I think we need reminders.
There is a marker
that, like, hey, the government dropped a bomb right here to get rid of 12 people.
There is some sort of a marker a few blocks away on the edge of the park.
Yeah, Philly is all about markers. It's weird that they don't have one there.
The residents of the neighborhood told them not to. They wanted to, and the residents were like, absolutely not. They just don't. They've been through so much already. Mm. One neighbor said, my hope is that it will be once again a beautiful community, and maybe once again we can be extended family. So that's the story of the West Philly MOVE bombing.
Okay.
Like I said, this has been on my list for a long time, and I thought that I knew what it was, and it's just, it turned into something completely different.
Yeah, that was a lot.
Yeah. Obviously, racism played a huge role in both parts of it. And
the heavy lifting.
Yeah. MOVE never would have gotten to the point that they did if they hadn't been targeted by the police.
Yeah.
But if they had moved in next to me, I would have wanted them gone too.
Of course.
The most fucked up part of this.
But you wouldn't want them to drop a bomb.
No. Obviously not. But that's the whole thing, is that the scandal here is that the neighborhood made the mistake of asking the city for help and expecting positive results.
That's like the story of a lot of people. They call the police wanting help.
Yeah.
And then, you know, their child is shot.
Yeah.
Ill child is shot.
I know.
And the police are like, oops, our bad.
Oops, yeah.
Your baby's gone.
No, I know. Complete disregard for these people's lives
for
their life, property.
For Black life, Black property.
Yeah. Because you know this would have had a very different outcome if this had happened in a white neighborhood.
They would have never.
Yeah, exactly.
Never. Dropped a bomb on a white neighborhood. Told everyone to leave on Mother's Day?
I know.
Karen would not have that.
Whew, I need this drink.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So I watched I read a lot of different sources trying to get the information, but I watched this documentary called Let the Fire Burn.
Mm.
It's very difficult to find. It's not really streaming on any streaming service, but I found it on this like weird website I'd never heard of, and it's streaming and you can watch it.
Okay.
So it will be in the show notes.
Yeah, I want to check it out.
It's not easy to watch, but I highly recommend it.
I find that there are a lot of documentaries like that are hard to watch, but like you're better for it.
Yeah.
Your eyes are wide open.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. It's all archival footage. The whole documentary is all footage from the news, from firsthand interviews. A lot of it is from the commission hearings. Most of it is from the commission hearings and interviews with Birdie.
Fucking mess.
I mean, I cried a lot watching it, but it's really good. Yeah. Okay, on that note, all it's right. time for a drink.
Yeah.
BRB.
Yes.
Whew.
Like love? Do you like love?
Then you might like More Than a Crush.
I'm Kim Berry.
And I'm Marion Bolognese. We're the hosts of More Than a Crush podcast.
Each week, we pick a theme and share a story.
We also have interviews and share your love stories.
So tune in. It may be rotten out there, but it's feel good in here.
More Than a Crush podcast. Listen on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast directory.
Bye. Bye.
Ooh, indeed.
That was a lot.
Sorry about that.
We had to exercise some
demons.
Some demons with some music.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear Quad City DJs, but I was overruled.
Oh, we put on Delight instead. Yes. Yeah.
I learned that the groove is in your heart.
It is. It sure is.
I've been looking.
Where is the groove? I thought Stella had it.
No. It's been in your heart this
the whole time.
It's like when that call comes from inside the house.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, wow. My story is lighter.
Thank the Lord.
But it's not hard to be much lighter than that. Anything is lighter than that. My story is very seasonal.
Ooh.
So November is Native American Indian Heritage Month. Oh. It's also the month of Thanksgiving. How on earth do we reconcile these two
things?
Yeah,
why are those?
Maybe we start by telling the truth?
No.
My scandal this episode is the invention of Thanksgiving.
Mm. Ooh.
Yes.
As much as I hate Christopher Columbus, well, that's not Thanksgiving.
No.
But
that's Columbus Day.
Pilgrims.
Yes.
Puritans. I hate the Puritans.
Yeah, they're not.
And what they've done to this country.
They're not great.
I hate the Puritans. I love Thanksgiving. But it's just because I like food. I love a food holiday.
So in school, we learned that the Pilgrims sailed from England in 1620, fleeing religious persecution. They arrived here months later. I think they got here in December. And they barely survived their first winter, but with the help of Squanto and the friendly Wampanoag Nation, they learned how to fish, to hunt, to...
You just put a fish under a stalk of corn and you're good to go, right? That's all you need to do.
They learned how to... Basically, they learned how to plant corn and squash and just generally thrive in this new world.
Ooh.
Yes. So the first Thanksgiving in 1621 was held to celebrate this harvest with the local tribe that made it all possible.
Hmm.
The Pilgrims, they were incredibly thankful, so thankful that they sat down to dinner with the Wampanoags in interracial harmony for 3 days for this, you know, this giant feast featuring some dry-ass turkey. I know you love turkey.
I prepare turkey. But also what they were eating was not what we think of as turkey. They were eating wild turkey.
So they have this big 3-day feast. A good time was had by all before things quietly took their natural course. The American colonies, they expanded. The Indians gave up their land and just faded from history, right?
That was it. They were just like, oh, you guys are here now? Okay, we'll leave. Goodbye.
Bye.
Everything's great.
Well, that's the gist of the story that I got. Almost none of that is true.
I'm not surprised.
Researching this story, I was so excited because I'm like, it's a story that everyone knows and everyone knows is bullshit. But like, I did not know the levels. Like, it's remarkable.
I mean, I knew it was clearly whitewashed.
Fantastical. Yeah. Yes. So I read an article in the failing New York Times called Everything You Learned About Thanksgiving is Wrong.
Ooh.
Turns out everything we learned about Thanksgiving is wrong, y'all. Like, everything.
So the headline was correct.
Yes. Yes. It wasn't clickbait. So let's raise our glass in toast to massacres, myths, and the making of our beloved November holiday.
Cheers.
Yes. I'm about to be raining all up on your Thanksgiving Day parade. Sorry. Oh, also, cheers.
Can I still have pumpkin pie, though?
Of course.
I just love pie.
Who doesn't love pie?
I mean, turkey is fine. It's definitely the least fun part of the meal.
Yeah, so before I jump into my scandal, I actually do want to talk about the food. What do you think was on the menu at the first Thanksgiving? Well, this
theoretical Thanksgiving that doesn't exist.
On what we consider American soil,
I mean, if it was all food that was native to the U.S., they could have had corn. They could have had squash. There wouldn't have been pies.
What did they have for, like, protein? Yeah, no, there probably wouldn't be pies.
Probably venison, maybe wild turkey. I'm guessing probably venison is the most likely thing on the table.
So you are zero for zero.
Oh,
so
fish?
Close. Alligator.
Alligator?
Turtle. Shark, oysters, catfish.
Okay.
This was a trick question. We are not talking about the very first Thanksgiving, the one in Florida in 1565.
Okay.
We're not talking about the one near the Texas border in 1598 or the one in Maine in 1607. We're not talking about the one in Virginia in 1619. We're talking about the one in Massachusetts in 1621.
They had alligator in Massachusetts?
No, the first Thanksgiving was in Florida.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, okay. I see. I get it now. Okay, that's why I was very confused.
Yeah.
I get it now.
You should be confused because we were taught that that was the first Thanksgiving, and it most certainly was not. Yeah. There were many.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll spend the next Novembers doing all the other ones.
So, do we know what was on that one in Massachusetts on the table?
They do suspect there was like a wild turkey situation, but there was no pie. There was no sweet potato because that was still really indigenous to the South America.
South America, yeah.
There was no butter yet here. But they were thinking it was mostly like oysters.
That makes sense.
Maybe some venison and wild turkey.
Okay.
So this was not the first Thanksgiving, as I've pointed out. I know you're probably thinking, like, was it even like a Thanksgiving? No, wasn't a Thanksgiving.
Was it like a harvest festival or something?
So the Pilgrim term for the event that we call Thanksgiving, they use the word rejoicing.
Okay.
They did have the word Thanksgiving, but a Thanksgiving for them featured fasting, prayer, and quiet reflection.
Fuck all that noise.
Does that sound like the Thanksgiving that we know? Of course
I hate that Thanksgiving.
Right? So a rejoicing was the opposite. It was a time to indulge in like rich food, like drink. It was a time to get drunk and basically shoot at things. Like they played with guns and they competed in feats of strength. Okay. So it was like Festivus.
That also doesn't sound like a Thanksgiving I would be interested in either.
Yeah, but the food and drink.
The food and drink sounds fun.
You don't need to wrestle.
Yeah, I'll just watch. It's fine.
You just like throw in some olive oil. I'm just watching, you guys. Just carry on. Yeah. So yeah, it was basically Festivus minus like the airing of grievances. Do you know like Festivus?
Seinfeld, right?
Yeah. So it was a party. It was not a prayer, like at all. It was full of people getting drunk and shooting at things.
And this wasn't the one in Texas.
No, this is. How dare you? You got me. I know this is a story that we can't tell kids. We can't tell them about like the joys of getting faded and shooting weapons.
Yeah. Because we can't ruin it.
Because we're telling them lies. Like we can't tell them the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like it was a rager.
Yeah. So the Thanksgiving turkey is like the Thanksgiving Santa Claus.
Yes. Essentially, yes. So a bit of background. Before the settlers came to the East Coast, it was home to various Native American tribes, obviously. The area we now know as southeastern Massachusetts and like eastern Rhode Island was home to the Wampanoag people. They had been there for about 12,000 years, give or take.
Oh, wow.
Really, really long time. So they summered on Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket before it was posh.
Ooh la la.
Yes. They moved seasonally in the winter. They were inland in the winter where they would hunt. And in the summertime, they'd be on the coast. You know, catching some rays, fishing, farming, living that life. Farming created a need for shared land use, and that created a need for like the indigenous version of like property.
Okay.
And from there, that created a need for savvy leaders, people who can navigate the needs of the tribe, but also make alliances with other regional tribes, and also make alliances with the new immigrants coming over on boats.
Okay.
So in the story that many Americans grew up with, there were no Wampanoags until the Pilgrims encountered them. This is false. In truth, there had been many, many other European settlers before the arrival of the Mayflower. These Indians, they were led by Usamequin, which was a rank more than it was like a name. It was like a title. It was like the head diplomat, more or less. So for hundreds of years, there had been violent clashes with Europeans. Many native people were captured and enslaved. Hmm. I found a story about a Portuguese slaver who kidnapped some Indians off the coast of Maine, and he found that two of them had like Venetian garb. Like they had already been captured by the Italians and brought back and made their way back to, wow. to home. This happened in 1501. So by 1620, when the Mayflower gets to Plymouth Rock, they're not the first.
Yeah.
Far from it.
Wow. Okay.
By 1620, the Wampanoags had had enough. They started chasing off any ship that tried to dock on their lands. They even drove off the Pilgrims when they tried to land on the Cape. So their first stop wasn't Plymouth Rock. They were trying to land on Cape Cod. And they're just like, no, not our summer homes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. The tribe debated for months on whether to ally with the folks at Plymouth in that colony or to destroy them. Mm-hmm. When they decided to begin their form of like diplomacy, they were guided by Tisquantum. We learned his name was Squanto. It's close. But what we did not learn was that he had already been previously captured and enslaved in England.
Wow.
From England, he went to Spain, then he was in, like, Newfoundland, and then he was, like, back to England, like, all over. But he became an interpreter in this time before eventually making his way back home to his tribe. So a year or so prior to the colony at Plymouth, there had been a really deadly epidemic, one that killed from 75 to 90% of the Wampanoag people and also the Massachusetts Bay people. Like Massachusetts was a tribe.
Wow.
I don't know if you knew that. No. I didn't know that. This new settlement at Plymouth was basically an Indian graveyard. The Pilgrims got so lucky landing there because the Wampanoags were still kind of licking their wounds because they had lost so much of their community.
Wow. Was it a European disease that wiped them out or? Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Wampanoag people that remained, they held tight to their land and they reestablished like a form of Usamequin, like leadership, like self-governance. They tried to do that again, even though there were so few people. But their historic rivals to the west were completely untouched by the epidemic. So they were outnumbered by them. After much debate, Usamequin, which is like their leader, he decided not to crush the kind of pathetic Pilgrims.
Big mistake.
Yeah.
Huge.
Because the colony had seen a lot of loss. Like half of the people from the Mayflower died.
Okay.
So they were kind of like, they knew what loss was like. And they're just like, okay, we can ally with them.
Yeah. Okay.
And they will protect us a little bit from these rivals, the Narragansetts, I think. I'm sure I'm butchering these names. I listened to a few
videos. I feel like I know how that's pronounced in like an American...
Something like that.
I think now we would say Narragansett. I'm sure that's not how it was. It's supposed to be pronounced.
Yeah. So after much debate, they decided to just ally with them. And you're like, first mistake.
Yeah.
So that spring, they established a mutual defense alliance with the colony at Plymouth.
Okay.
We were taught that the Pilgrims extended a warm invitation to their new Indian allies and neighbors.
Sure. Yeah.
Nope.
Not surprised by that.
This, too, was a cornucopia full of lies. The Wampanoags showed up uninvited to the harvest feast.
Oh.
And it was not simply like four or five of them, because in photos we see like just like a sprinkling of brown.
Uh-huh.
They outnumbered the Pilgrims 2-1.
Wow.
Usamequin, he arrived with 90 of his strongest men. And the colony at Plymouth was less than 50.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
The natives, they came not to enjoy some like... fantasy post-racial feast with their new friends. They came because they heard gunfire and screaming.
Oh, screaming?
Yeah, because they were having those like feasts of strength. They
came
to their aid. So they arrived with an army because they honor treaties.
Sure.
Yeah, they came to defend them.
Wow.
So they arrive and the Pilgrims are so confused because they're drunk and they're just like, why are we surrounded by brown faces, basically? So it seems like it took a while for people to like sober up and know for the Pilgrims to know that they weren't under threat.
Sure. Yeah.
Because they kind of were just very suspicious of anything that Indians did.
Yeah. I mean,
they saw as like a sign of aggression.
Mm-hmm.
So after some time, both sides realized that no one was hurt.
Yeah.
They were just like shooting guns and screaming and having a good time. And like no one was trying to hurt each other.
Okay.
They then awkwardly spent the next 3 days together.
Weird.
And these are the facts of the 1621 event that we call Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
This is what happened at this rejoicing. So no real like century long ritual came from this event because it was awkward and weird.
Yeah.
Like no one wanted to really remember this. Mm-hmm. It was just like this thing that happened. But New Englanders, they did celebrate Thanksgivings usually twice a year in the spring and in the fall.
Okay.
But it was the real Thanksgiving. It was like the fasting and the quiet reflection.
Oh.
Thanksgivings.
No, thank you.
But these Thanksgivings, they always followed a really bloody battle where they overpowered the natives.
Okay.
So that's when they would quietly give thanks.
Gross.
I know. So much for thanking your neighbors yeah. for all of their help.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, us.
I know. Pilgrims, they did the colonizer thing. They leaned on Indians to give up their land through quote-unquote sales driven by debt, politics, threat, and violence. You know, sales. Mm-hmm. They played this game of, like, divide and conquer. They'd be like, you know, he said that he agrees to sell his land. Don't you agree with him? Like, just causing division within the tribe. That's how you win. They considered Indians their inferiors, so they're just like, whatever. Like,
yeah.
We're just gonna lie to them and steal their shit. So Usamaquin's son, who the English called King Philip, I don't know why.
Weird.
I should have looked into it. It was really, really weird. But King Philip, he formed a resistance because he was just really tired of all the fuck shit, basically.
Yeah.
Despite the really bad odds, like, there was no way that he was going to win. By 1670, the immigrant population had ballooned to 7,000 people.
Holy shit.
Which was twice the natives.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they had guns.
Exactly.
Wow.
But all the cheating, stealing, and abuse eventually drove the Wampanoags into conflict that we refer to as King Philip's War.
Okay.
And it ended when Plymouth men mounted the head of Usamaquin's son on a pike, where it remained for 2 decades. During this time, his dismembered and unburied body just lie decomposing in a cage.
What the fuck?
For all to see, super neighborly. And these are like the pious, good, godly pilgrims. So in truth, massacres, disease, and tribal politics are what really shaped the pilgrim Indian alliance at the root of our, you know, the holiday that we call Thanksgiving. But the myth of this Thanksgiving covered up the fact that King Philip's War was caused by us. It was caused by our relentless seizure of land. Like,
yeah.
We pushed them to this, and it kind of covers up the consequence, like the fact that we broke up the Wampanoags into 2 tribes,
uh-huh.
and, like, we broke all the other native alliances in the area. And, yeah, it ended with all of that, and then, you know, the colonists giving thanks.
Mess.
Mess, yeah.
Mess.
So, like most colonial wars, this was one giant slave expedition. Yeah. Shocking, right?
Wow. Yeah, I'm not shocked by that, but I guess I never even really considered that.
Yeah, same. So the Wampanoags, they were judged as criminals and sold into bondage, which kind of foreshadowed the 13th Amendment.
Good Lord.
Like, you're free unless you're a criminal, but your skin makes you a criminal.
Yeah, it's illegal to breathe if you have brown skin.
Yeah, basically. So during the next 2 centuries, New England Indians suffered indentured servitude, convict labor, debt peonage, which also often resulted in the enslavement of debtors' children as well.
Oh, good God.
Yeah, so once slavery is outlawed, you gotta rebrand it anew.
Mm-hmm.
Them are the rules.
Them's the rules, yeah.
Thanksgiving's like pilgrim pageants. They suggest that like good-hearted, noble settlers arrive from pious England with their, you know, tea and crumpet. But in reality, they came from a land that delighted in displaying severed heads on spikes for 20 years.
I mean, good times.
And just letting bodies like rot in cages for all to see. But I thought only savages did that.
It's okay because you're doing it to a savage.
I missed that footnote.
Oh, yeah. I just, I know how to do those mental gymnastics.
I see that. So limper.
Yeah. It's just in my jeans.
Yeah. Oh, no. Throwback to last episode. Wow. So this Thanksgiving fairy tale that we celebrate today was birthed much later, centuries later, actually, in an effort to lay this foundation of this, like, fantastical American community, like, mm-hmm. founders, basically. So in 1941, the Reverend, his name is Alexander Young, he's the nobody. Mm-hmm. He's just like a reverend who published something once.
Yeah.
He published a story that linked three things. The 1621 rejoicing, the tradition of like autumnal harvest festivals, mm-hmm. and the word Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And that was all. That was enough to just make it a thing. It was like a throwaway comment and a footnote, but people picked it up and they ran with it and history was made. People just started calling rejoicings, like autumn festivals, Thanksgiving.
Good times.
Isn't that just so classic?
Yeah. I think that the understanding that I had of it, the way that I sort of learned it, which I'm sure was totally incorrect.
Yes.
Was that they sort of like brought them back in the 40s as a way to sort of like celebrate New England heritage.
I'm getting there, yes. You're close to what happened. New England had been celebrating rejoicings as Thanksgivings, just like regionally.
Okay.
And I think a few states had it as like a state holiday.
Okay.
But it was after this, because he's the one who like pulled it all together.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So a few decades later, Sarah Hale, do you know who Sarah Hale is?
That sounds familiar, but I can't think of it.
She's a Mary Had a Little Lamb fame.
Okay.
She's the queen of the Mary Had a Little Lamb empire, if you will.
I'm trying, like, I feel
she's
like
an author.
This is all coming together in my head. I feel like I've heard this before, but I can't remember now.
Okay. Maybe as I continue, it'll form. She suggested to President Lincoln that the country needed a day of unity and remembrance to counter the trauma of the Civil War. This is how I found out about this when I was researching Lincoln.
Okay.
I'm just like, oh, he made Thanksgiving a thing. And then I looked into Thanksgiving. I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
So in 1863, Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday of November to be a national holiday called Thanksgiving.
Okay.
They moved it up a week because of shopping, basically. I think it was FDR, actually, that moved it to the third Thursday to, like, stimulate the economy, which is a great way to move a holiday. That's already fantastical to begin with, so it's like, whatever, who cares?
Moved it further into November?
From the fourth Thursday to the third Thursday. It's the third Thursday now.
Okay.
Yeah.
That does make sense. I mean, if Christmas is like, there was like a big issue in retail, I think it was last year, that Thanksgiving was later in the year and it was too close to Christmas and everyone was freaking out that the shopping season was too short.
That's exactly why it was pushed up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So American, essentially myth makers, decided that this narrative of a harmonious Pilgrim Wampanoag feast should be like the root of this. Because they felt that New England as a whole and just pilgrims in general were like the perfect setting and cast of like American founders.
Sure. I mean, we love a good story.
Yeah.
It makes us sound like way better people than we actually are.
Exactly. They were white. They were Protestant. They appeared to be wholesome in the stories that we made up about them. They wore belts.
I mean, buckles and everything. Buckles all over the place. Buckles on the shoes, buckles on the hats. Who doesn't love a good, wholesome buckle? Yes.
So they looked the part, basically. So this new creation myth, it neatly aligned with the defeat of the American Indian resistance in the West, because this is like the mid-1800s. Mm-hmm. Like they're crushing native populations left and right. So this was like kind of like a, look over here.
Yeah, no, we're the good guys. It's fine.
And it glorified the endurance of like sturdy white men from New England now, these founders. It diverted attention from all of the brutality of Jim Crow that was happening and all of just the racial violence in the South. It completely ignored the foundational role of slavery.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, no, let's not mention any of that. It was genius. Like, it was so smart. It allowed people to avert their eyes from marginalization of Asian and Latinx, like, labor communities that were popping up at the time and being crushed. It ignored the racialization of Southern and European people, Jewish people in the country. They're just, again, it's like, look to New England. Like, everything's cool here. It was so good. They ignored the whole eugenics thing.
Yeah.
That is still here with us. At Thanksgiving, white New England cheerfully shoved reality to the side and claimed America for itself. So a lot of my information came from excerpts and reviews of the book This Land is Their Land by David Silverman. He's a history professor at George Washington University. He begins his book with a call to arms for like a possibility of a nuanced, like critical view of history when it comes to Thanksgiving. But he says that he knows that it'll be, quote, hard on the living.
Yeah.
Ain't that the truth? But he says we have a responsibility to try now that we know the facts of the situation.
And all the stories that we do on the show are like things that are not fun to hear and not fun to sort of reconcile with. But it is important. There is a reason that we're forcing you to listen to this, Gus.
Yes. But he warns against the temptation of what he thinks could be like fighting myth with counter myth. Uh-huh. Like just like glorifying the Wampanoag people as these like perfect victims.
Mm-hmm.
But they are survivors. Like they struggled. They fought it out within their community. Like as they were being genocided, like they had disagreements. They had ego. They did a whole bunch of things wrong. They definitely failed to realize the peril that they were in until too late.
Yeah,
they were people. I think that what we should talk about at this event that we call Thanksgiving is how the Wampanoag people held on, because they're still here.
Yeah.
So many men were dead or enslaved after this. So many. That Native women, they married outside of their group, often African Americans. And they redefine their families, their mixed marriages, on matrilineal lines so they can hold on to their land. Like, it was so smart. Like, women are just incredible.
Yeah.
Like, they carried their culture and they preserved it. They adopted, when I read this, I'm like, this is cute. They, like, adopted a form of Christianity, like, to some degree.
Okay.
Because they're living in New England and they kind of want to fit in.
Sure.
And it kind of, like, gave them some breathing room and some space.
Okay.
But I just picture them being like, yeah, we're Christian. Just don't come to our church.
Yeah, don't come to church. And
there's, watch. Like, a teepee in there. Yeah. Like, we're like you, but you don't trouble yourself.
Yeah.
So they were really remote. Like, their reservation area was pretty remote, so they were able to maintain self-governance. And by the late 20th century, they brought back their language from the brink. Like, there were only, like, four or five people who were still able to speak the language, and they taught it to everyone.
Wow.
And, yeah, they gained federal recognition as a tribal nation. They split into two, but they're both still a thing now.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's so, it's so fucking cool. And today, the Wampanoag people, they debate whether Thanksgiving should be a day of mourning or a chance to contemplate reconciliation.
Yeah.
When I read that, I was just like, chills. Like, they're just so generous.
Yeah, yeah.
Reconciliation.
I mean, don't hold your breath.
I know. But again, this is what every non-white group wants, just to live in peace. Like, we don't want revenge. Yeah. We don't care about your ill-gotten gains. Just let us live in peace.
Yeah.
Say you're sorry and move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't hold your breath. But still, they're considering it, which is so beautiful. I think that every Thanksgiving needs to be a reckoning that Native American people are still with us.
Yes.
Because I learned about them in the past tense in school.
No, absolutely. Right?
They're not ghosts. They're actual living people. Mm-hmm. They're nations. They're still here, despite what we tried to do to them. I think we need to dead that lying ass, like, this land is your land. This land is my land shit. It was Silverman's book that made me realize that Indigenous people don't get to be you or me in this. Like, this song is trash. Like, we need to throw it in the fire. And I really, God, I really hope kids aren't doing those pageants with the construction
headdresses,
paper, headdresses.
I feel like that stuff is a thing of the past.
Oh, good. Okay.
I hope. I don't know.
I hope that people aren't doing that still. Yeah. Like, we know better now.
Yeah.
We need to throw that in the fire, too. Like, we need to stop telling kids lies.
Yeah.
It's not helpful. But I don't think Thanksgiving should be canceled, like, at all.
Yeah.
Like, at all. I think that it needs to be a day of quiet reflection and mourning for non-Native people like you and I. Mm-hmm. We need to mourn collectively the loss of our beloved childhood fable we call the first Thanksgiving. We need to burn all the lies with all the construction paper, with all the belt buckles, maybe throw in some sage. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm just going to end by saying, the fact that the Wampanoag peoples survived and adapted over millennium is something worth celebrating, something worth remembering annually. I think this is a great story to tell to children. It is a story of struggle and survival and thriving. Like, we don't need to tell them lives about Thanksgiving. We can tell them the truth minus the drinking and the guns.
Yeah.
The end.
I'm all for it. I'm all for telling the truth.
mean, controversial opinion.
Yeah.
Telling the truth.
I know.
But it's not a bad story.
Yeah. You can tell bits and pieces of it without telling the violence.
Yeah, you don't need to tell about the severed head. We can leave that out.
Oh, my goodness. You know that song, This Land Is Our Land, is...
fucking garbage. Go on.
It's a socialist anthem. It's not...
Is it?
It was written by Woody Guthrie.
I don't know who that is.
It's like a big hippie. Okay. It was like a...
Okay.
It's not like an American patriotic song in the way that people have co-opted it.
Mm.
It was meant to be like, this land is... belongs to everyone.
I do get that.
Yeah.
But it's like, still, Indigenous people don't get to be either.
Absolutely.
So he was still thinking about them.
He was
in a past
white man that wrote the song.
Yeah.
But it's not what people think it is either.
Okay. That is good to know.
And it's funny. It's actually ironic that it's become this sort of like capitalist American theme song that's exactly the opposite of what it was supposed to be.
And I think, like, doesn't Bruce Springsteen, like, Born in the USA, isn't that still like, the right has tried to co-opt that song, but it's really about like socialism and like being like a poor working class person in New Jersey.
I'm not surprised by shitty, awful people co-opting anything.
I think Springsteen like sued, maybe it was like the Bush campaign for like using his song. They're like, oh no.
Yeah, absolutely not. Good for him.
Yeah. Did you know any of that about Thanksgiving?
I knew little bits and bobs. I'd forgotten some of the stuff.
I mean, you knew it was lies because
everyone
knows. Like, saying that should not blow anyone's wig off.
I did know the part about, what was her name? Sarah Hale?
Sarah Hale, yeah.
I did know about her, but I'd forgotten about it. But I knew there was some kind of story of a woman kind of like bringing it back from somewhere else. I think that I learned this on the MSG podcast, Masters of Social Gastronomy.
Hmm.
They do an episode on Thanksgiving, mostly focusing on food history.
Okay.
Because that's what the show is about.
Of course.
But talking about like the introduction of certain foods throughout the years and why certain foods became traditional. But they do talk about like what would have been eaten at probably the first Massachusetts Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
If you're somebody that loves food history and Thanksgiving in the same way that I do, it's a fascinating episode.
Yeah, I need to listen to it.
I like that you tied Thanksgiving into that episode for November because my story was just...
You know what you did with your story.
I did it. Yeah. Well, thank you for telling that. Yeah. I like that. I appreciate that story a lot. I really enjoyed
that. Yeah, I thought it's good balance.
Yeah.
I knew that Thanksgiving was horrible, lying bullshit, but I didn't know the levels.
Yeah.
I did not know that it wasn't the first. I didn't know that it wasn't even a Thanksgiving. Like, I didn't know that the Indians weren't invited. Like,
that is such a weird detail.
Crazy, right?
That they just showed up to like help them. And
they heard
gunfire.
We just drunk. Yeah, no, we're crazy rednecks, basically. Yeah,
we're just shooting guns into the air and screaming for no reason.
Because it's fun.
Wow.
We see them as this like buttoned up, quiet.
Yeah.
Like the picture that's painted of them. You're not thinking that they're getting drunk and just shooting into the air, like pew, pew, pew.
The Scarlet Letter, like Esther Prynne.
Yes.
Self-flagellating for...
They most certainly are not.
Well, okay. Good to know.
Yeah.
Well, I give you thanks for telling that story.
Thank you.
And on that note, I guess our drinks are empty. I have a few suspicious berries at the bottom of my glass.
Yes, you have a whisper, a splish splash.
Yep, it's gone. The end.
You did it.
America's history is juicy. We just add dry white wine and lemon lime soda, some mixed berries. Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lerzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Thank you so much to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and powerful wizard.
Yes.
We could not do this without you.
Affirmative.
The end. Bye.
Bye. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.